We're talking about the spice trade and a Wisconsin family's contribution here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The book is dedicated to Grandma, who is salt, and Grandpa, who is pepper. The matriarch and patriarch of the Penzi family were undeniably experts in all things spice. And this little Wauwatosa spice store was connected to far-flung places, to a merchant spice trade. And centuries later, that spice house had its burlap sacks and barrels of spice with hundreds of apothecary jars lined up on tidy shelves. We're going inside the Penzi Spices story, and we're checking out what's on your spice rack. What are your favorite ones? What flavors do they add to your cooking? And what do you love to add into drinks? What spices do you have a hard time finding or affording? Join in throughout the hour, 800-642-1234. Caitlin Penzi Moog is the author of On Spice, Advice, Wisdom, and History with a Grain of Saltiness. Caitlin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So your grandparents established the Spice House in the 1950s. This is decades before you were born, but you spent a whole lot of time there growing up. What are some of those vivid memories?
Yeah, my grandparents sort of babysat me and my brother and sister, and we worked at their spice house from the times, you know, in my book, there's photos of my brother and sister and I mixing and blending spices when we're like 2 years old and 3 years old. So I was just born right into it.
You had big mallets and you're pounding. I'm like, this is a little kid who's got a mallet in their hand.
It was so fun. And that's not how spices are made at all. But they were just like, here, take some cinnamon chunks and just go to town, kids. So yeah, it was really a fun upbringing. I learned a lot without knowing I was learning anything. They were really good teachers. One of my favorite things that we did when we were kids was my grandfather had this vision of turning Wauwatosa, Wisconsin into a saffron capital of the world. And saffron is one of the few spices that can grow in colder climates. And so we very laboriously packaged up saffron bulbs and wrote out instructions and then handed them out to all the neighbors.
You were putting them in mailboxes.
Yeah, which is, you're not supposed to do that. But the Wauwatosa citizens didn't get us in trouble, and I think a few neighbors planted the bulbs, but unfortunately Wauwatosa is not known for its saffron, but you can buy saffron bulbs and grow them in Wisconsin.
Saffron, very labor intensive and really expensive. What is it?
Yeah, so saffron is the stigma of a flower. It's a little crocus. And it is a specific kind of crocus, and it's known for its really long stigmas. So there's only three stigmas in the flower, and those stigmas are the saffron threads or filaments, they're called. And so there's, you know, these are tiny flowers that take up acres and acres. It takes something like, you know, it's like 200,000 flowers for a pound of saffron. So you can just imagine how much labor goes into
hand harvested.
Yeah. So what they do is there's this sort of small window. I think it's like 10 to 15 days when the flowers open up. They sort of cut all the flowers at that point when they open up, bring them to tables where it's more comfortable, and then, yeah, pick out the saffron threads out of the flowers, and then, you know, they have to sort of cut the yellow part away from the red part, because it's only the red part that has the flavor and color. So if you look, the highest quality saffron is just the red filament. The you know, I say quote unquote lower quality, it's still very good quality saffron, but the threads will have like a yellow or orange part on the end, and that doesn't have the color or flavoring. So they're cutting those parts away, and then they're drying them. So it's, you know, people are like, why is it so expensive? And it's like the labor that goes into it is just bonkers.
Yeah. And so I would put a thread of saffron in my rice, but I always wonder, am I, you know, putting too little or too much, because you have to do it so sparingly.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, luckily with saffron, a little bit does go a long way. With the rice, what I learned from my grandparents was the head of a dime. You would take a dime and put enough saffron to sort of cover that dime, and that was a good amount to put in your one serving of saffron rice.
Is that why your father or your grandfather would put a penny?
Yeah. So it was a penny, and then I think it changed to a dime at some point. Yeah, a little less. You decided you actually needed a little bit less saffron. Yeah.
We're talking with Caitlin Penzi-Moog. She's the author of On Spice, Advice, Wisdom, and History with a Grain of Saltiness. What questions do you have about spices? What are your favorite ones? What flavors do they add to your cooking or your meal prep? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Caitlin, when it comes to smells, they can bring back so many memories for anyone, regardless of whether they're in the spice business or not. Do the smells of any spices remind you of your grandparents?
Yeah, well, you just kindly made me this really spicy tea at the studio.
I did.
And I talk about, in my book, I talk about just cassia tea, which is literally just chunks of cassia steeped in hot water. And I drink that, and I think it's because it reminds me so much of the spice house and growing up there. And it's something my grandfather would make in this little Mr. Coffee pot. But he would just run the hot water over, you know, with the cassia chunks in the pot.
Now, cassia and cinnamon, explain.
Ooh, yes. Yeah. So what mostly what Americans call cinnamon, most of it is cassia, technically. So cassia and cinnamon are closely related. They're in the same genus of tree. So they're kind of cousins, which is interesting because they're not the same. They're very close, but they're not the same. And so Ceylon cinnamon is true cinnamon. Sometimes you'll see on a label it says true or like Veritas or something that's indicating that this is cinnamon. And then the Kerinchi cinnamon, the Saigon cinnamon, and the Chinese cinnamon, those are cassias. And so sometimes on those labels you'll see it labeled like cassia cinnamon. Okay. But Merriam-Webster Dictionary and other dictionaries actually, like, while I was writing the book, I got an update email and they were like defining, they were redefining, or not redefining, they were updating the definition for Saigon cinnamon. And they define Saigon cinnamon as a cassia sold as cinnamon. So that just goes to show you, like, our understanding of what we call cinnamon in this country is like cassia is cinnamon, but it's technically not.
When you say like Saigon cinnamon, it reminds me that, you know, these spices are coming from really far-flung places that have deep roots in history from centuries ago. What about the spice trade that is so fascinating to you that you can bring these spices and these stories from far-flung places here to Wisconsin?
Yeah, it is, like, it's really cool when you step into a spice store you're getting spices from, even just cinnamon, from Vietnam, from Indonesia, from China, you know, from the Spice Islands, from India, just all, like, the whole world is sort of coming together in one place. And you are getting, you know, there's, I just did a reading last night and I was talking about Sancho pepper, which is not a true pepper. And it's this fun, it's green. It has a very sort of citrusy taste, but it sort of tingles on your tongue. It's like electrocutes your tongue. So it's really fun. So I was like having people try it at my reading for those who dared. And someone was like, oh, so like, what do you cook this in? And I was like, you know, from what I can tell, you use it in meats a lot, things that are sort of like fattier and heavier because it's this really strong thing. And then someone in the audience was like, oh, well, I use it in da 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 da. And she was a Chinese woman and she was just like, of course I know how to use this. And I was like, I'm so glad you're here because it's just something that I have and it's like a novelty. But of course, it's like really rooted in this person's culture, you know?
Sure. Yeah, it comes from somewhere. We're talking about spices with Caitlin Penzi-Moog. She chronicles growing up in the spice trade with her family. She is a grandchild of the Penzi family spice craft. Her book is called On Spice. Are you the cook with shelves of spices in your family? Are you trying to teach your children or grandchildren about spices? What have you found to be effective? What works? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this hour's conversation on spices in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Thank you. You're with us as we talk spices here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for being here. We're learning the Penzi's spices origin story in Wisconsin and this family really steeped in the spice business. And along the way, we're getting practical advice on so many spices in our cabinet. Think saffron, vanilla, ginger, turmeric. The list and the jars are really endless. How do you love to mix spices? What spices do you think go together well? Which ones are you often pairing? And what questions do you have about saffron, about cinnamon and nutmeg or other spices? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Caitlin Penzi Moog's book is called On Spice, Advice, Wisdom, and History with a Grain of Saltiness. And Caitlin stays with us. Let's go to the phones now with Donna joining us from New Berlin. Hi, Donna.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I just love this topic. And I just want to tell you that spice has been such an important part of our family and cooking together and trying different spices that 2 months ago when my daughter got married, we bought little 2-ounce jars off the internet and we filled them with all sorts of different spices. And then we put a little tag on top that said, love is the spice of life. And we gave out all sorts of spices to the over 200 people that were at the wedding. And they loved it.
Oh, that is so special. And, you know, those little jars will go into people's cabinets. And every time they see it, they will have that memory.
Yeah, they will. And hopefully, I gave them some different spices that maybe they've never tried before.
Like what? What did you give them?
And then, so we gave them all sorts of different peppers and like Himalayan salt. Some people said, what's this pink salt? I said, that's Himalayan salt. You know, all sorts of different things. It was great.
Well, Donna, that sounds like a wonderful favor and a very special parting gift for guests. So thank you so much for bringing that story. Donna mm-hmm. mentions Himalayan salt, and we could launch into this full-on salt explosion here because you go really deep into salt, Caitlin. And as your grandfather would say, salt is salt.
Yeah. Yeah, Himalayan salt is really having a moment right now. And yeah, the salt is salt saying is, so 95% of all the salt that you're going to eat is sodium chloride. And 5% is sort of the variation of, you know, a color like in Himalayan salt. And maybe it's absorbed minerals or algae. It just absorbs a lot of things over centuries of lying dormant. So really, you're going to taste salt when you eat salt. I do think Himalayan salt it's beautiful. Like it glows. It's very pretty. And it's kind of like a showstopper to like bring out for special occasions. So I totally understand the appeal. And I think it's a great like wedding favor because it is something really fun and, you know, kind of fancy. I like it for food. I was about to say,
you know, when do you salt food? Always.
Yeah, always. So pink Himalayan salt, like that's the real deal. There's a lot of sort of imitators now that are sort of seeking to capitalize on how popular that is and how pretty it is by just sort of dyeing different salts. But that stuff really has absorbed stuff over centuries. And it's not going to be around forever. You know, that mine will have an end. There's one mine in Pakistan that all of our pink salt comes from. And, you know, the makers are kind of coy about when it's going to run out. But I have a guy who says maybe 50 years more at the current levels of production is how much pink salt you will have. So when I see it being used as like lamps and like these sort of things where it's like you're inhaling pink salt at a spa, I'm like, use it for food. Don't use it for other uses.
So you have a salt shaker in like every room.
Yeah, I do.
I'm surprised you didn't bring one in for
this
interview.
Oh my God. I have one in my car. Yeah. I brought that up and I was like, oh yeah, I have like 4 different salt shakers at home. And they were like, oh, so you have like your kosher and your gray and your pink. And I was like, no, they're just kosher salt in all of them. And that's because I use kosher salt for like 95% of things. And I just don't want to be carrying it around from room to room. So I have my little salt cellar in the kitchen. And then I have like 3 shakers in every room at my house. And at work, I would leave like a salt trail behind me when I ate my lunch. Yeah.
So kosher salt, very versatile. You yes. use it most of the time. What is it?
So kosher salt. So basically the differences that you see in salt is really about the texture more than the flavor. So kosher salt is my favorite because it has such a wide surface area. The best way to think about it is that table salt, the sort of classic idea we have of salt, are very small granules of salt. So they're like ice. They sort of fall onto food and bounce around. Kosher salt is like a snowflake. It falls gently on the food and it sort of melts over it, and it really evenly distributes the salt flavor that you want. So that's why I like kosher salt, because it really does just cover a lot of surface. It melts very easily into food. You can kind of like pinch it between your fingers, and it has such a nice texture that's really good for like pinching over foods. And it's just you actually end up using less salt that way because it does distribute more evenly than other salts.
We're talking with Caitlin Penzi-Moog. She's the author of On Spice, Advice, Wisdom, and History with a Grain of Saltiness. You can join in the conversation on spice and what is in your spice rack. What questions do you have about spices? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email your questions to ideas@WPR.org. Caitlin, you use salt pretty liberally, and we've all heard from doctors, cut back on salt. Why do you feel that we should be able to add salt to our cooking when you find it appropriate?
Yeah, I do hear a lot that we should be cutting back on salt. And I mean, I think that's probably true. But I think what gets lost is that we consume most of the salts in our diet from prepackaged foods and from restaurant foods. You know, like fast food burgers are just like packed to their breaking point with salt. And that's why they taste so good. And so if you want to cut back on salt, you should be reducing things like sliced bread and bottled salad dressings. And that is really going to decrease your intake a lot more than what you would decrease by sort of reducing the salt you add at the table. That salt that you add at the table is sort of like a minimal amount of salt compared to all the salt you're getting in prepackaged foods. So my philosophy is cut back on those foods if it's an issue. Don't cut back on the pleasure of like salting your green beans and making your food, you know, and like your healthy food that you're cooking at home. You want that to taste as good as you can. So like sprinkle that salt on there and cut back on the other stuff if it's an issue.
You have a pretty broad view of spices. You include herbs and minerals and seeds and leaves. How do you define what makes something a spice?
Yeah, it's such a good question. And I spent so much time researching this question for my book. And I start my book with salt, which is controversial. Salt is not plant life. Salt is a mineral. It's a rock. Basically, the conclusion I came to is that I don't want to be pedantic about it. And I sort of ended up looking at my own spice rack at home and being like, you know what? All of these things are spices, because spices are things, in my view, that you're adding to your food to make it taste better. And so I am liberal with that. It's like it's dried goods. And I think it can be, I mean, I'm not going to say it's like, oh, it's whatever you want it to be. But these sort of distinctions that people are really preoccupied with between what's a spice and what's an herb, I find silly. And that salt is something else. And it's like, I guess salt is important enough that it can stand on its own and just be like its own all important category. But salt plays such an important role in bringing out the flavors of food. And salt is in so much of the seasonings. You know, a lot of spice seasonings have a lot of salt in it. And so this idea of divorcing salt away from spices, I just found wrong.
I love this story about your friends finding MSG and
yes.
finding it on their pizza.
Yeah. We just had frozen pizza one night, and I have this very large spice rack, as you can imagine. It's actually like several different racks and shelves sort of cobbled together in my kitchen. And there was this one white powder, and it was the reason I didn't know what it was is because the label was written by my grandfather, who had like notoriously messy handwriting. And so So they read it as M56. And we're like, what is this secret special spice that like Katie has at home? Oh my gosh. So they just sprinkled it on their pizza. I think they were looking for like some herbs or something to put on the frozen pizza. But they sprinkled this stuff on and they came back and they were like, what is M56? It's so good. And I was like, yes, that's MSG. And you're right, it is. MSG is amazing. And I wish more people took advantage of it because it's been really unfairly stigmatized. It doesn't give you headaches. That's a myth. There's been no science to corroborate that. You know, it occurs naturally in foods. It occurs in mushrooms and Parmesan cheese. Like if you've eaten those foods, you've had MSG. So this idea that it's bad for you is totally wrong. So I've never sprinkled it on pizza before. I usually use it in like soups and, you know, things that like you're cooking on the stove. But you can just put it on whatever and it's going to make it taste. It's going to bring this delicious umami flavor. And it's a flavor potentiator, just like salt. It's gonna enhance the flavors in your food.
We're talking with Caitlin Penzi Moog, who grew up working for her family in their spice shops in Milwaukee and Wauwatosa. Her book is called On Spice, and she writes so fondly of her grandparents' small spice store and lessons she learned. Salt is salt. Throw out the grinder. Do you think twice about salting foods? Do you grind pepper? What do you want to know about what's lining your spice rack? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the Penzi's spices story after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about a life in the spice business and the origin story for the Penzi's spices. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Caitlin Penzi Moog is a member of the family that operates these spice shops across the country. And she defines spices as those powders and seeds and leaves, liquids and minerals that she adds to food to make them taste better. And she sees this as a really broad definition. Lucky for spices, they belong in the kitchen. We know where to find them. What questions do you have about spices? What are your favorite go-to ones? What flavors do they add to your cooking? Are you a chef or a bartender? How do you incorporate spices into your creations? Join in along the way, 800-642-1234. Caitlin Penzi Moog stays with us. Her book is called On Spice, Advice, Wisdom, and History with a Grain of Saltiness. Let's go back to the phones now. Cody is joining us from Watertown. Hi, Cody.
Hey there, how's it going?
Good. What about spice?
So my son, we decided at a really young age that we wanted to expose him to like lots of different spices. We read that it's really good for their taste buds if they like become familiar with spices. His favorite meal is my home-cooked spaghetti, which is a pretty simple tomato sauce with some pork and beef and then just Italian spices. So it was his birthday yesterday, so we made it. But I was wondering, like, what are some other really great spices that I can use or maybe other parents can use, because I feel like it's a really common misconception where kids like don't get exposed to the spices and then they grow up and they don't really want to try things because they don't know what it tastes like. So what are some like really good ones that we can start trying? I mean, we kind of expose them to everything in our cabinet, but what are some other ones that we can try or other parents can really get their kids interested in?
Cody, thanks so much.
I love this question, and I love that you're exposing your two-year-old son to spices. You know, I think using the sort of like milder spices as an entryway point, this is something you probably already know, but like my thoughts go to something like taco seasoning is like a really good, mild, salty, delicious seasoning. I actually add it to a lot of vegetables, not just in tacos. You know, and I've heard, I spoke to an Indian woman once who told me that she added like cinnamon to her meats to start getting her son prepped for curry, for like the really hot ones. And yeah, something just like those milder ones. And like, even like something like cardamom, and cumin, like, and garlic, like those, if people think of them, they're like really pungent, but when they're used sort of in moderation and with salt and pepper, I think those are really good ones to sort of like start building like an all-purpose, sort of go-to spice seasonings for a lot of different foods. And I know Kate was telling me about she does with her
kids. My kids, with their buttered noodles, they like everything super plain, but I like experiment and try little, you know, different seasonings just to incorporate into those buttered noodles. And, you know, sometimes it turns out great. Sometimes they're like, Mom, what is this fleck on my buttered noodle? But, you know, like a chip dip seasoning, they love on their buttered noodles. It just gives a little more zest. I'm not exactly sure what's in the seasoning, but, you know, I've tried different things.
And I think like salt and pepper and herbs and garlic. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Those are sort of my go-to base almost of spices that I use on a lot of different things. So, and they're really easy, I think, especially garlic and then just herbs like basil and rosemary and oregano. Those are flavors that just go well with so many things and sort of blend into a lot of different stuff. So those might be good ways to get your son into it.
Cody, thanks so much. Let's go to Lori now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Lori.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate that.
Sure.
And I'm just curious. I get most of my spices from the Indian stores, and I grind my own stuff. And I've been going for like about 25 years to the Indian store across the street from Mayfair Mall. Mm-hmm. And I put turmeric in everything. I even cook my greens with turmeric. I use a chicken broth, and I put the turmeric, a teaspoon of turmeric in, and the black pepper. And an Indian friend is the one that taught me to add the black pepper so it boosts what the turmeric will do for the body. And then another thing, a person gave me a gift of a bottle of Tellicherry peppercorns.
Tellicherry.
Is that what it is, Tellicherry or Tellicherry?
I think it's Tellicherry, but I might be mishearing you.
No, that's it. That is it. It's just I haven't picked it up and looked at it in a long time.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Tellicherry?
Okay, so Tellicherry is actually just the kind of peppercorn that you're getting. So there's a lot of pepper that's made in the world, but Tellicherry is basically the top 10% of peppercorn size-wise that they're sort of sifting, you know, because the larger the berry, the stronger the flavor. So Tellicherry peppercorns are sort of the top 10% of the pepper crop. So that's good pepper, what you're getting. And it's just Tellicherry is just sort of the name that denotes that it is like that top 10%.
And should you be grinding your pepper?
Oh, yeah, Lori, I'm curious. So you're saying that you buy your spices from the Indian store across from Mayfair, and you grind it yourself. I definitely grind my own pepper. You know, grinding your pepper, you're absolutely releasing the flavor, the oils that are sort of inside this little container of the peppercorn. So by grinding the pepper directly onto your food through a grinder, it's releasing the flavor. Like, you cannot have fresher pepper, and that's the appeal. But I'm curious, do you grind other spices yourself?
Cinnamon. I grind my cinnamon.
Wow. That good for you. That's commendable. I personally don't do that because I just find it kind of labor intensive.
I'm single. And you just, you know, and it's in a jar. I got that at the Indian store, too. It's the whole, you know, the whole cinnamon with the roll. And you just take what you need. You break a piece and you grind it really quickly. And I have a specific grinder for spice. Got it for cheap $5 at Lowe's, I think it was.
Wow. I mean, good for you.
That's
You're
great.
Getting really fresh. You know, it literally cannot be fresher than grinding it at home yourself. So that's commendable.
Now, another thing, I'm just curious. Turmeric is no way of running out, you know, because everybody's eating it now, finally. I've been eating this stuff for a long time. So it has no chance of running out, does it?
I don't think so. I mean, all spices are subject to a lot of different factors just because they are crops and, you know, spices, most of them grow really close to the equator, and there can be any number of weather disasters that can wipe out crops or, you know, really what that translates to for American consumers is just higher prices. Sometimes you will randomly see a spice that spikes in price, and that's probably because there was some sort of natural disaster where they're grown.
You look at vanilla, it goes up and
yeah,
it
exactly.
goes down.
Vanilla is a really good example of the sort of trade, the forces that spices can be subject to. So Yeah, to answer your question, I don't foresee turmeric running out despite its popularity. It's been a really big spice in other parts of the world for a long time. So I think that the production can meet the demands.
Lori, thanks so much. Let's go to Cherie now in Milwaukee. Hi, Cherie.
Hi. I just have a cute story for Caitlin. I knew your grandparents and really shopped the Spice House years and years ago. I think they used to be over near 35th Street.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, I had a brand new seeing eye dog. I'm totally blind. And we went into Penzies. And as we were walking back to the counter, my dog, being young, dipped her head down and came up with, from a little basket, a mouthful of peppercorn. And Ruth said, "Oh, my, what a way to meet you, Visa." She said, "We have a great big bucket of water for you." And my dog drank and drank and drank.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, every time I went into Penzies after that, excuse me, I'm on Prospect Avenue here. Every time we went into Penzies after that, that dog would take me to an aisle way to the right and down to the counter.
No lesson learned. Oh, that is such a wonderful story. And I'm sure it just, for you, Caitlin, brings back such warm memories.
I honestly can't imagine eating a mouthful of peppercorns. My grandfather used to have us take a single peppercorn and put it in between our back teeth and bite down. And this was for the purpose of sort of tasting the differences between different kinds of pepper. And one peppercorn on its own is so hot and so strong without the food to sort of ameliorate that flavor. So like a whole mouthful, I feel so bad for that dog.
Well, you call pepper the king of spices. Where does that phrase come from?
Oh, my gosh. So pepper accounts for about 1/5 of the spice trade in the world. So and pepper has one of the longest histories. Its history goes back 3,000 years or more. And so I think the reason it was called the king of spices was just, you know, sort of like, oh, it's one of the most important spices. It accounts for so much of the trade. I actually did some research, and this isn't in my book, but I ended up doing a lot of research trying to figure out where this phrase comes from. And I thought it would just be in every single book about spices, and it is not. It really didn't come into use until the 90s, and it came out of sort of industry pamphlets and like spice conference notes about pepper. They started calling it the master spice, and then they started calling it the king of spices. And in the 90s, cookbook authors glommed onto this phrase. And that's just always growing up. My grandparents called pepper the king of spices and cardamom the queen of spices.
Oh, well, cardamom gets to be queen.
Yes.
And so our pepper grinders, they're okay in terms of, you know, grinding instead of just shaking on.
Absolutely. So if you're buying pre-ground pepper from somewhere like Penzies or the Spice House, like you're getting really fresh pepper that's like, you know, maybe a week old, if that. So not to say that, you know, pre-ground pepper is necessarily bad, but you are getting the absolutely freshest pepper you can by grinding it directly onto your food. And the idea that pepper makes you sneeze is actually from ground pepper that gets dusty after a while. And that's never going to happen. You're sneezing from the dust, not the pepper. And that's never going to happen with a fresh grind pepper.
We're with Caitlin Penzi Moog, whose book about cooking with spices is crafted around growing up with her family in the spice trade. Still time for you. What spice rules do you have that everyone follows in your family? Do you grind? Do you never add black pepper to pale sauce? Do you only buy spices from certain stores? Join in. Still time for you. 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about spices and a family's tradition in the spice business. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The Penzi story and the practical advice, it all layers together with author Caitlin Penzi Moog, who writes about her grandparents' cozy spice shop in Wauwatosa, founded in the 50s when their family's journey with spices began. Her grandfather blended in philosophy. He told her that spices had music in them if you knew how to listen. And she remembers retreating to the sugary warmth of the vanilla room. Are you the cook with shelves of spices in your family? Are you trying to teach your children or grandchildren about spices? What have you found to be effective? Join in 800-642-1234. And the new book is called On Spice, Advice, Wisdom, and History with a Grain of Saltiness. Let's go back to the phones now. Carrie joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Carrie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to ask, so what's the difference between cooking with like a garlic salt versus garlic powder, and then you have to compensate with other salts, or I don't know, just around that, I guess.
Garlic salt is basically just garlic and salt added together. So I think the difference between cooking with garlic powder and cooking with garlic salt would just be that theoretically, if you're cooking with garlic salt, you wouldn't need to add as much salt as usual. And if you're cooking just with garlic, you probably would want to add a lot more salt in because you're not getting it from the garlic salt. And sometimes garlic salt comes with some herbs mixed in. You know, it can be a little fancier. So sometimes what's called garlic salt, if you see like green flecks or things, you'll be like, oh, there's other things in there too.
Carrie, how do you use garlic powder and garlic salt in your cooking?
I like to make my own veggie dip.
There you go.
Yeah, sounds good.
That's go-to. Thanks so much, Carrie. Let's go to Josh now in La Crosse. Hi, Josh.
Hi, how are we doing today?
Good. How's your spice?
Oh, I absolutely love the Bébert spice.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely wonderful. We use it with grilling and put it on meats and throw it in a bunch of different sauces as well.
And is this is the kind that you use very hot?
It's not really a hot. It's almost more of a smoky flavor.
Ooh, okay, yeah. It's fun because that's a seasoning that has so many different sort of components. It can be like there's no standard for. I've pronounced it Bébert, but I guess it might be Bébert. There's no, you know, sort of standard recipe or components for it. So it can sort of run the gamut from the kind that I've had has been pretty spicy hot. So the idea of like a more smoky profile for all those spices sounds really nice, too.
Do we know any of its history, where it comes from or, you know?
So it's really big in Ethiopia.
So
if you go to like an Ethiopian restaurant, you might be getting it on the food there. And it has a lot of ingredients that we don't like a lot of spices that we don't really use in this country. Nigella seed is one that's it's a fun spice. And for whatever reason, it just has never really gained a foothold here. But it is like coming to Americans through Bébert seasoning.
Josh, thanks so much. Let's touch a little bit on vanilla and the vanilla room in your grandparents' store. How have you seen the evolution of vanilla and how we make it and serve it and its history?
Yeah, vanilla is a really interesting spice because it's for most of spices and most of history, spice only came out of Asia and sort of India and China and the Spice Islands. And so when Europeans, you know, quote unquote, discovered the New World, there were suddenly these new spices that went sort of the opposite way for the first time in history and came into Europe from the New World. And vanilla is one of those. It originates in Mexico. And it was first just used as a perfuming agent, but it was actually the people who lived there, the Teutonic people, were the first people who developed the sort of drying, and there's a lot of fermenting that goes on with the vanilla pod to develop the flavors. If you just pluck it off, it's just going to be like a green bean almost. You really have to – it has to go through this pretty rigorous process of fermenting and drying and fermenting and drying.
Like you pack it up at night and move it and then bring it –
Yeah. So it's – you're literally putting it in like an airtight container to ferment it for a while. And then you bring it out for a few hours a day to start drying it out. But then it's still going back in its container to ferment. And then after – that goes on for a few months. And then for like 4 to 9 months, you're drying it out. So it's this really – long process that was developed a really long time ago. And the Aztecs started using it to flavor their chocolate, which also, of course, comes from the New World. And so the story goes that Cortez, when he was here, you know, colonizing, he loved the chocolate, and it was really bitter. You know, if you've ever had like dark chocolate, you know, it's actually like really bitter without a sweetener. And vanilla was used to sweeten it, to bring out its nice chocolatey flavor and make it more palatable. And so he brought back hot chocolate to Europe. And, you know, obviously a lot of like those people who were European who were discovering these things brought it back. But it was used mostly as a perfuming agent until Queen Elizabeth I's pharmacist sort of started utilizing it because she had a famous sweet tooth. And so he, because spices were used medicinally for so long in Europe, her pharmacist was the one who had access to the vanilla because it was used as a drug. And so he's the one who was like, oh, this would be good in sweet, tasty things that the queen really loves to eat. And that is how it became sort of used in desserts in Europe. So you can trace its history through this really fascinating chain of events.
Imitation vanilla extract, so much less expensive. Avoid it?
Yeah, I mean...
Tell us what you really think.
So it's called vanillin. And so vanillin, it's like... vanilla, real vanilla, is so complex. And you can talk to people in the sort of industry of like flavoring, and they have this flavor wheel that has all these thousands of components of flavors. And vanilla has just a very complex profile. Vanillin is some of those pieces of flavor, but not all of them. And that's why it tastes sort of like vanilla, but it lacks the depth and the beauty of real vanilla. Having said that, real vanilla is, as we mentioned earlier, very expensive, and sometimes its prices can spike. There's such a demand for vanilla that the producers really can't keep up worldwide. So vanillin definitely has its place, and it's actually been estimated that of all the sort of vanilla-flavored things out there, only 1% is flavored with real vanilla. So you're probably, if you really like vanilla flavor and you're eating it in a lot of things, you're probably eating vanillin, and it's probably okay because it's with a bunch of different flavors and everything. But if you're cooking at home and you're making something yourself, I would absolutely want you to use real vanilla because it does make a really big difference, and it doesn't taste like the sort of artificial and poor imitator that vanillin is.
Take that, you chocolate chip cookies. Caitlin Penzi Moog is the author of On Spice: Advice, Wisdom, and History with a Grain of Saltiness. Let's bring in James now in Wabasha. Hi, James.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you all today?
Good. What's on your mind about spices?
Well, when I lived in Homestead, Florida, there's a tree that was brought in. Unfortunately, it's invasive, but it's the Brazilian pepper, and it has the red peppercorns. And we used to keep bees, and we kept the bees near a patch of the Brazilian pepper. And the bees actually gave a peppery flavor to the honey.
Wow. James, we're running short on time here, but a Brazilian pepper tree and bees, that all sounds like, you know, a recipe for some cool spices going on there.
And that honey sounds incredible. I want to try that.
Well, as we wrap up here, what do you hope that we experience from spices as we look and open our spice rack, our cabinet each day?
I hope that you're just using spices to make your food taste good. I think that's their role, and you really don't have to overthink it any more than that. And you can use them in whatever way you want. Like, you can use cumin outside of Mexican food, and you should, because it's an amazing spice on all sorts of things. So I really hope that people can just understand their spice rack as this wide open world of possibilities to make their food taste good.
Very quickly, a few seconds, do spices go bad?
Spices don't really go bad. They just lose their flavor over the years. We say 5 years is sort of the longest you should keep them around. They're not going to mold. They're just going to sort of slowly lose their potency and their color and their flavor. So you're going to want to replace them or just use them quicker than that.
Caitlin, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Caitlin Penzi Moog is the author of On Spice: Advice, Wisdom, and History with a Grain of Saltiness. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.